Okay, I think I can start this morning's talk now. It's the last few talks have been on the jhanas, deep insight and enlightenment. And you can't really go further on that direction. So I was going to backtrack a bit now, and maybe I should have mentioned this earlier, but still it's good to mention it now anyway, the different methods or attitudes in meditation which can empower your samadhi just by coming at it through a different angle. And also just some of the interesting techniques or ways one can use to enhance even the breath meditation. So what I'm going to be talking about today is some of the different attitudes, skillful means, ways of meditating which will actually will enhance the practice, empower the meditation and lead even closer to jhanas. One of the first ones is actually developing inspiration. Because as you will know by now, that when you feel fed up, depressed, what am I doing this for? You get up on the wrong side of the bed in the morning. Sometimes it's hard to get into any type of deep meditation at all. But if you've heard like a really rip-roaring Dhamma talk, you're really inspired, and you're full of energy and faith, wow, yeah, let's do it, then meditation gets easier. So this is why that, you know, we need like the inspiration. So that sometimes we get the opposite of inspiration, which is expiration. Which is when we come here full of inspiration, and then because of unsuccessful respiration, we get desperation, and desperation ends up in expiration. You expire, all your sort of energy and your hope all just vanishes. So it's good to keep on the inspiration. In other words, like to build up some sort of faith and confidence, some really nice energy inside, which is one of the reasons why we do some chanting, because the chanting can be sort of very, very inspiring, especially when we chant in English, we listen to the words, say, wow, this really makes sense. If you don't know the words, sometimes you're chanting things which Buddhists have been chanting for 26 centuries, and that really, really inspires you. It was fascinating that there was two Sri Lankan boys who, when they were very, very young in this life, they could chant spontaneously. They knew all of these ancient chants, only about 6 or 7 years old, and those tapes were recorded. I know one of those guys, he's been to our monastery before, he came for a visit once, and that I got one of his tapes, and I sometimes play that for inspiration. There's this about 7-year-old boy who chants all these amazing Pali suttas in perfect pronunciation, and it's fascinating. It's not the way that Sri Lankans chant it these days. It's much closer actually to how the Westerners chant it. And there you see that he remembered that he was a monk about 1500 years ago, and he could recall that past life, and he could recall all the chants. He chants it absolutely perfectly. And when I listen to that, it's a young boy, you know, 6 or 7 years of age, doing the chanting. And it's beautiful to hear, and it really sends goosebumps up my spine. And I get very inspired when I hear all of that. Just to understand just the whole lineage and the tradition and where this all comes from. And it just shows in 1500 years, that chant hasn't changed at all, not one iota. And that's amazing to see just what a strong lineage that is. That's almost like finding a book written a long time ago. This is a guy who can remember the past and just chants. Not like the Sri Lankans chant today, but chanting in a way 1500 years ago. So it's fascinating. And that sort of stuff really inspires me. So if you ever feel a bit dull or worn out, I sort of play that tape. And then, you know, you start. Meditation's really easy. And it reminded me of one of the teachings of the Buddha, because he had a cousin, Mahanama, who was a street widow. But he had difficulty getting to jhanas. Well, they actually didn't know whether he was or wasn't a stream winner. He had difficulty getting to jhanas. And the Buddha said, what you should do is actually do some reflections on the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha before you start meditating. He never explained actually why he did that, but it came quite clear to me that if you reflect on something really inspiring, it gives you energy. Not just the energy of restlessness, but the energy of like this faith, inspiration, wow, this is just so beautiful and so wonderful. And you tend to aspire to what you're inspired by. It's another aspiration, the aspiration. You have to have inspiration before you can aspiration. And what that really means is that you get so, your mind is is what we call like leaping, inclining, going towards what it's inspired by. And so if you do some reflections on the Buddha, I don't know what you think of the Buddha or what concept you have of the Buddha, but you can actually have some sort of general concepts of the most compassionate, wise, peaceful person. I like to actually to remember the compassion part of it, because the compassion part of it means that, well, if I'm going to be inspired by the Buddha, I should try and act like a Buddha, and especially with the compassion towards my mind states. So if ever I'm lazy, or if ever sort of I'm restless, or if ever I don't do the right thing, I've got the Buddha mind. Ah, oh, never mind, you're okay, be compassionate, you must be tired, you know, you can't always be successful. When you tell a joke, it's a matter of course that sometimes no one's going to laugh, so never mind. And I have this wonderful Buddha compassion towards myself. And because I have compassion, because I'm reflecting upon the Buddha never sort of strangled anybody or beat anybody or was very cruel to anybody. So I said, I'm not going to beat myself or be cruel to myself or be hard on myself at all. You create the Buddha mind because you're inspired by that. And if you can create like a Buddha mind before you meditate, this beautiful compassion, letting go, this very great softness, just the ill will, guilt and all that negative stuff, they just can't come up. You're almost just imagining what a Buddha is. And that's the way you're going to meditate, as close as you can to your concept and idea of a Buddha. Or you reflect upon the Dhamma, all these teachings which you've heard over the years. And some of those teachings have been absolutely magnificent. Just one word at the right time, and it's just changed your whole life. It saved a huge amount of suffering. Sometimes this Dhamma has actually stopped many people committing suicide. There's one fellow, he's one of our ex-caretakers, and he moved to a remote part of Western Australia, and he was getting very, very depressed living by himself. And he only had a caravan, and he had a big shed outside. And one day he decided he had enough. So he tied the rope. He put the rope actually up on the rafters of his big shed, and he tied a noose. He put a chair so he could stand on the chair, put the rope around his head and jump off. He was about to kill himself. That's how close he came. And then he went into the caravan to write his suicide note, so people would know that he hadn't been murdered, he just had enough and he was about to commit suicide. Fortunately he had the radio on, the ABC. And as he was writing the note, who would come on air but Ajahn Brahm? And he thought, oh no, this is a sign, I can't get away from this monk. So he screwed up the note and he untied the rope and he came and told us about it. He needed a little bit of inspiration, a bit of Dhamma at the right time, and saved his life. So sometimes, sometimes you can get inspired just, you know, by the Dhamma and just the truth and what happens sometimes. It does actually save your life. And sometimes some of the most beautiful things in the world which you've heard, you know, they're not sort of songs by Elton John or music by the Berlin Philharmonic. Sometimes some of the best sounds you've heard is like words of wisdom. And wow, they're just so amazing, so wonderful, so meaningful. And the most precious things you've had in your life. So you reflect upon all the Dhamma. Reflect all the Dhamma you've heard even on this retreat. On all these amazing words. And you think, wow, this is amazing. How wonderful it is to be in part of such a wonderful performance of Dhamma. And you deliberately make a commentary which creates inspiration around the Dhamma. You don't do any fault finding, but you just go in there and just make a lovely commentary of how beautiful and wonderful it all is. And you inspire yourself. And you get this wonderful energy, this joy, this inspiration. Or you choose the Sangha. All these great monks and nuns, these teachers have you seen. One of the nice things about being in Perth is actually you don't just see monks fly in. You see monks being born. You see them grow. You see them mature. Monks being born is like the ordination ceremonies which you have. You go down to our monastery and you see these little men in white, the Anagarikas. or the Anagari calves in the nuns' monastery. You see them when they first grow, are born. Just like a little child, they can hardly walk in their robes. They keep falling off. And little by little, they learn how to speak and to walk. And you watch them, you nurture them all these years. And then you see them one day, and right, they do a novice ordination. You see them wear brown, you start to see them grow. And then you see their monk ordination. And then one of the nicest times is you see them when they give their first talk. And wow, this is almost like part of your family you're seeing growing up. And you see turning into teachers themselves. And you think, wow, what a wonderful thing this Sangha is. How inspiring. And you're part of it. Okay, we're up here sort of giving the talks. But without you, we could not exist. You get a piece of the action every time I give a Dhamma talk. They say the gift of the Dhamma is the highest, most precious gift you can possibly give. It's not just my mouth. If I didn't have a breakfast this morning and a cup of tea, I would not be able to speak. And it's all of you who have helped make that breakfast or serve that breakfast or bring it there. That gives you inspiration. And I tell people whenever they bring food to our monastery, especially during the rains retreat, during the Wasa, that's the most inspiring time when all these monks, all the nuns at Dhammasara, are really practicing hard for enlightenment. And this actually came from the teaching which the Buddha gave to Visakha, the chief lady disciple of the Buddha. Because she said, can I please be the one who offers these bathing cloths to the monks when at the start of the rains retreat, and also to the bhikkhunis as well. May I also be the one, when any monk or nun, when one first comes to this city, can I invite them to my house first of all? I'll give them a dana. Because the first day, they don't know where to go, offer alms round. They don't know who's who. My place will be the first place they can come to, so I can actually settle them in, show them where to go for alms round, and give them food or whatever. And maybe just before they leave, if they go on a journey, can they come to my house? And I'll give them whatever they need, a new pair of sandals or whatever else they need for the journey. And if any monk is sick, please tell them to, you know, to come to my house. If they can't come to my house, and send one of the monks looking after them, and I'll give them the special food in times of sickness. And maybe I have to look after the nurse monks as well, because they won't be able to get their own food. Please may I serve in this way. And the Buddha said, well, it's a very wonderful thing, but we can't just give it to you. That's for everybody to share that merit. Why should we give it to you? I mean, Visakha, this was a killing statement. She said, well, if you give that to me, then I'll know during this rains retreat, if there's any monk who gets a jhana or who gets a stage of enlightenment, I know I would have fed them when they first came here. And I probably would have done other things for them as well. I would know that whoever gets a stage of enlightenment in this monastery, I would have helped. And that would give me such inspiration and joy that I'll be able to cross my legs and sit down and get deep meditation. And because of that deep meditation, I too will be able to see things as they truly are. And I too may gain one of those stages of enlightenment. When the Buddha understood just how wise that woman was, how she understood one of the great causes for deep meditation, for wisdom and enlightenment, he said, yes, I will give you that special permission. Not because you asked, but because you understand. And sometimes that you get very inspired when you think of all the great teachers which have come through this place, all the people you have served, all the great Sangha you have supported, and that makes you inspired. And you think of that Sangha and you go, wow, I've made huge merit, great good karma. Look what I've been doing to help the world by helping some of these great monks and nuns. I've been helping really push this Buddhism along, not just incense Buddhism and just rites and rituals and superstitious Buddhism, but the real Buddhism. Wow, I'm part of this. And when you feel part of this, it really inspires you. I use that inspiration a lot to power my meditation. Many of you know how hard I work, you know, physically, and sometimes if it's late at night, You know, you should be exhausted. You should be wiped out, worn out, some of the things I get up to. But sometimes I just sit down there on my cushion and I start to think, what have I done today? When I start to think of all the amazing good karma I've done, this is not ordinary karma, this is huge karma, then I get so inspired. Wow, you're all this beautiful, emotional, almost crying, but not quite. Don't let the tears out, just keep that energy within. Close your eyes and put all those tears into the mind and get this incredible, powerful, joyful emotion. And then when you try and watch the breath, oh, it's just so easy. Oh, it's nice, it's so easy. Because you're inspiration. And that's how I gain a lot of energy. On those reflections, on the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha, or that last one, which is my favorite, it's called Chaganusati. It's remembering, reflecting on how much you've given. And that really powers you. When I said earlier that you've all got heaps of good karma, you don't realize just the mass, the mountain of billions of good karma points you have in the bank. But you don't know how to get it out and make use of it. This is one way. The old saying is, you've got heaps of money in the bank, but you've forgotten your PIN number. So you just can't get it out. This is four PIN numbers for you. Every one works. Reflecting on the Buddha, reflecting on the Dhamma, reflecting on the Sangha, reflecting on what you've done, how much you've given, what you've actually helped, you know, push this sasana, this meditation, this teaching along. And when you do that, and you put that number in, you get all this incredible energy and power coming out. That's coming from your good karma. That's coming from your reflections. That's coming from inspiration. And I saw that. It's straight from the words of the Buddha. He said, if you get inspiration, he called it Dhamma Veda Atta Veda. You know the Vedas, which you may know of, that's actually like inspiring stuff. And that's what Veda means, like inspiration. You almost sometimes shake with joy when you get really inspired. And that's why sometimes I've listened to talks by some of these monks, either on a CD or in person, and afterwards, wow, that's amazing. And sometimes you just sit there and it's easy to meditate because you're running on this inspiration and the joy which comes from inspiration. And that's what it said in the sutta. Once you get Atta Veda, Dhamma Veda, the Dhamma means, like, you know, in the source, where it all coming from, the Atta, and how this is going to work out, it's the consequences. And then you get so much inspiration. Wow, this is amazing. And you get this great source of energy. Not restless energy like drinking coffee. This beautiful, pure energy coming from right within inside of yourself. You energize yourself. And once you've energized yourself, that beautiful energy of peace and happiness just powers you along. So, if you're having any time of dullness, if you think, only one day to go, will I make it? Come on. Well, I can always sleep in the afternoon and have a rest. Instead of actually wasting the time, get inspired. Put in that sort of powerful inspiration there. Make a sort of little commentary to get yourself going. And then it's, wow, yeah. Also be inspired by the fact that the reflection, that it's not just, you know, great beings who become enlightened or get jhanas. Sometimes just the most coarse, unlikely subjects get these jhanas and get enlightened. Because sometimes you read in the suttas, some of these people were just street sweepers. Some of them were sort of hunchbacks. Some of them were little 7-year-old novices. Some of them were prostitutes. And they just sat down there and gained jhanas and enlightenment. They could do it. And sometimes when you read some of the stories, that gives you inspiration. If they can do it, wow, so can I. And some of the great part of those stories is sometimes they were so far away, it seemed. They didn't know how close they were to jhanas or enlightenment. Many of them gave up. Some of the classic stories. And this is not a recommended practice for you this afternoon, but there was this one nun who'd been a nun for 7 years, and she said in her poem, never once did she have any peace in her meditation. Not even once. Now, I don't think any of you fall into that category. At least you've had some peaceful meditations, but for 7 years, and you've only been doing this for 9 days. So after 7 years, that was it. She'd given it everything she got. And she did not want to go back to being like a housewife or to being a servant. But what could you do? There was only one option. She went into the forest with a rope. She tied one end of the rope to a branch of a tree, climbed up on that branch, and put the other end around her neck. And she was just about to jump off when her mind was liberated. She had enlightenment experience. That's why I say I don't recommend that, because it probably won't work for you. You'll probably jump off first, and I'll get into big trouble, and so will our Buddhist society, and the police will be around here. We'll never be able to use this place ever again. So that's not recommended. But why did that happen? She did not know how close she was. Or like Ananda's story. Ananda, just before the first council, the Buddha had passed away, and all the monks wanted to meet together to make sure they understood and agreed what the Buddha taught and what the rules were, what they weren't. So all these, they decided to get 500 monks to have this meeting. 499 were fully enlightened, the one wasn't, that was Ananda. It's just the same. If I told you that of all the people here, everyone was enlightened, everyone had got jhanas, were arahats except you, and you think, oh my goodness, everyone else but not me, even that Jojo sitting next to me who's always been sleeping, never been out once in for morning chanting, I mean they'll be stuffing themselves on a mobile phone all day making noises in the showers, and they're enlightened. It's unfair. This one Nanda thought, because he'd been looking after the Buddha, he'd been working so hard, and all these other monks were enlightened but not him. And that was the last day, just like today's the last day. Tomorrow was the big meeting and he hadn't made it yet. So he said, right, this is it, I'm going to meditate all night, nothing's going to stop me. And he meditated all night. Now in the morning, when the sun rose, he wasn't enlightened at all. He was as far as ever from enlightenment. He didn't think he even had a chance of getting enlightened. He had made no progress whatsoever, meditating so hard all night. So what did he do? He decided the meeting's going to be another hour or two, I'd better get a couple of hours of sleep. So he went to his bed, he lay down, and just before his head hit the pillow, he became an arahat, fully enlightened. Which is why I recommend that practice to you. Go back to bed, you never know, this might how many tries have you been doing that, the Ananda method? Some of you have had experiences like that though, very similar, not maybe enlightenment. We've been meditating all day, really trying hard, getting somewhere, but then you go and decide, okay, I had enough now, lay down, and just as you're laying down, or just beforehand, the mind becomes very clear. Sometimes you see nimittas. It may not last. Why? It's because you've been letting go, you've relaxed at last. That's the teaching of Ananda. That's the teaching of that nun. She just decided to let go. She gave up. She was going to kill herself. Now that's what you should sort of do. Just let go of your body. Stop trying. Give up. Abandon. Stop. It's one of my favorite similes. I can't resist telling it here again. The simile of the donkey and the cat. Again, this is another original Ajahn Brahm simile. I've got the copyright on this. This does not come from the Buddha or Ajahn Chah. The donkey simile is this. In southern Europe, they used to have donkey carts. And the only way they can get a donkey to pull a cart is to put a stick on the cart, which protrudes about maybe 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick is a string. On the end of the string is a nice juicy carrot, about 2 feet in front of the donkey's nose. And the donkey smells that carrot, sees that carrot, and goes for the carrot. However that donkey moves towards the carrot, because the carrot's on the end of a string, the string's on the end of the stick, and the stick is tied to the cart, the carrot also moves forward. So it doesn't matter how much you go towards that carrot, the carrot goes the same speed away from you. And that's like life. Even like jhanas, you're almost there. Well, say nimitta, there it is there, and you go for it, and it goes a bit further away. You go for it, and it goes a bit further away. Sometimes it goes forever away and disappears. Sometimes in meditation, it's almost in your grasp. You think you've got it, and you move towards it, and it moves away from you. Just like the carrot and the stick. Or the carrot and the donkey, rather. And sometimes that's what life is like. Sometimes you almost got happiness. You can see it, it's right in front of you, but you just can't reach it. However, as you all know this story, you should know if you've listened to me before, when Buddhism came to Europe, the donkeys, they learned some Buddhism because they learned how to catch the carrot. That's why you never see donkey carts anymore in southern Europe. They know how to catch the carrot. How do donkeys catch the carrot? They see that carrot in front of them and they run like billy-o after that carrot. They go full speed, put everything they've got into catching that carrot. But they catch the carrot. However fast they run, the carrot goes at the same speed in front of them. But the difference between an ordinary person and a Buddhist donkey is a donkey knows how to stop. You have been chasing the carrot for the last, I don't know how many days. Now, stop. When you stop, the carrot goes even further away. That's like when you let go. The mind goes to sleep, goes crazy, have all this stuff going in your mind, which doesn't go in your mind when you're controlling it. Sometimes when you let go, enlightenment, peace, jhana seems to go even further away than it is usually. But that's par for the course. The donkey lets go, stops, and the carrot swings further away than it's ever been before. But the donkey has faith, wisdom, and mindfulness. The donkey just sits there, does nothing, and waits. Soon the carrot's furthest away it's ever been. Can't remember the carrots being so far away ever before. But it doesn't lose faith. He just is patient, mindfulness, and waits. And the carrot starts coming towards you. Soon that carrot's in its normal place, about 2 feet in front of your mouth. But for the first time in its history, it is now coming towards you at great speed. And all you need to do is wait a little bit longer, and the carrot swings right into your mouth as you open it. And what do you say? The door of my mouth is open to your enlightenment. Come in. And that is how enlightenment happens. You just sit there. That's why Ajahn Chah said, just wait for the mango to fall. Wait for the carrot to come in. But you've got to stop first of all. Otherwise, it will never come in. That's all one needs to do. So that's actually the inspiration. And that's how Ananda became enlightened. Pushing all evening, all night. That carrot was going so fast, he just stopped, whoosh, bang, straight in. He was enlightened. So that could be you. He thought he was a long way from enlightenment. That nun who almost committed suicide, she thought she was a long way from enlightenment. You don't know how close you are. The simile of the Buddha was a big water jar and have water dripping in. But that jar is bigger than you. You can't lean over and see how much water is in there. All you know is just one more drop is going in and another drop. That's all you can know. You don't know if that jar is half empty, quarter empty, or almost full. One more drop, just like any other drop, and then it overflows. One more meditation, which starts just like any other meditation, and then wham bam, you're in jhana and everything comes. You never know when it's your time. Who knows? That could be today. So this gives you inspiration when you actually read these things, and please believe me, this is what happens. Sometimes the most unlikely people, suddenly it all comes together. Doesn't matter who you are or where you come from. Just when the causes are ripe, the most unlikely tree just blossoms and all this wonderful fruit falls off. Sometimes not in the right season, but there it is. You don't know. And that gives you inspiration. It gives you confidence that yes, you can do this. Too often people say, well, maybe those monks and nuns, they can get into jhana, but I am just a simple householder. I've got all my defilements. How am I going to be able to do this? This is my 10th retreat and haven't even got into beautiful breath yet. What hope is there for me? Now, why don't you start thinking like that? You are killing all hope. As any professional coach knows, your job is to tell people if they're playing soccer, the ball is round, it can go anyway. And you all know that sometimes that happens. There are upsets. Bottom teams beat the top teams. People who aren't supposed to win, they do win. And why do they win? Inspiration. They believe they can do it. And because they believe they can do it, they do it. So you can do it. You can be enlightened. You've got a body and mind just like all the arahats of the past. They were probably worse than you are. They managed it. So you can. You will. Yeah. Hallelujah. I'll do it. I shouldn't break this up by being silly about this. But you can get inspired, and inspiration works. If you believe you can, you will. So be careful of that self-doubt. Doesn't matter how many times you've meditated. That is no measure of what's going to happen next. Sometimes, and I know the personal experience, you have the most hopeless meditations, and the next one is a deuce, it's a winner, it's a beautiful one. You just don't know when the conditions are right. So you get inspired. Yeah, we can do this. Inspiration is important at the beginning of the meditation. If you're not inspired, if you're really depressed, oh, I'm not going to be able to meditate, this is going to be a bad one, I know it's going to be a bad one, it's definitely going to be a bad one, then you can bet your life it's going to be a bad one. You just made it a bad one. So just, if you're going to do anything, psych yourself up. I can do this, it will happen. And believe that, because it works. It's just basic psychology. That's my job, to tell you, yeah, each one of you can. I should really lie to you, but I can't lie. If I lie, I say, yeah, now over half of you have got jhanas already. And then you think, wow, really? All those other people and not me? Even though I'd be lying my head off, but it would work, I think. It would. You say, oh yeah, they can do it, I can do it. It'd give you belief. And that belief is powerful. So motivate yourself. Reflection on the Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha, reflections on the meaning of these things and inspiration. It can be done. It is being done. There are arahats alive today. There are people who achieve these jhanas. It can be done. It is being done. So go for it. That's one of the great things about living with a great teacher like Ajahn Chah. Wow, it can be done. You can live this pure life, just like you read in the time of the Buddha. and you can just have all these achievements. Isn't that amazing? Then yeah, we're going to do it now. So those inspirations. The other thing, which one of the other things to use with meditation, is use some imagination. Not just inspiration. Imagine what it's like to be enlightened. When you close your eyes, just imagine you're an arahat, fully enlightened. If you're going to fantasize, fantasize big time. Now, I'm saying this because it actually works. This is a good, skillful technique. Imagine you're an arahat, sitting there, no desires, just so peaceful, just so calm, just so much compassion for the whole world. And then start watching your breath. When you imagine that you can be an arahat, or you are an arahat, it changes the whole psychology of your mind. Now, change that. Imagine you're this idiot meditator who just can't watch the breath for his life. Imagine that. And of course, that's what you do all the time, isn't it? And that's why you don't succeed. So you can use imagination, and it works. You're stacking yourself up. Now, one of the reasons I got this is this meditator a long time ago, and he never told me who taught him this, but whoever taught him this, whoever taught this was a great meditation teacher, because he could not watch his breath for his life. You know, he'd start watching his breath, start thinking all sorts of different things. He'd try and watch his breath with force, and he would just get all ugly and sort of very uncomfortable, and it all just fall apart. And he was just so frustrated. He was a good Buddhist. He liked to meditate, you know, but he just could not do it. Then one teacher told him, said, look, don't try to watch your breath. Just imagine watching your breath. Just close your eyes and imagine you're watching your breath. Just imagination, not real thing, okay? Just imagine watching, going in, going out, going in, going out. And after 2 or 3 minutes, the teacher said, what are you watching? My breath, he said. It was just a psychological sort of blockage he had. I can't watch the breath, therefore he couldn't watch his breath. So just say, imagine you can. And he was. It's amazing just how that works. So if you can't be in the present moment, just imagine you are. Imagine what it's like just to sit down and be in the present moment. Imagine what it's like. Just imagine. Don't do it. Imagine what it's like to be silent. Imagine with your eyes closed, you're this monk and nun in this beautiful monastery in the mountains, some place which is not cold like Tibet or Himalayas, but just nice and warm. This beautiful idyllic monastery, you're just sitting there. Are you peaceful now? Of course you are. Imagination is very helpful. So you can imagine when you start meditation, not that you're sitting in this room in North Perth, imagine you're in this most exotic, peaceful, beautiful, idyllic monastery with all these holy arahat monks and nuns. Some of them your old friends, and they're just there smiling at you as you're in this amazing monastery up in the mountains, far away from anywhere, with the mountain birds chirping in the background. And you've already done so much, and you're so still, so peaceful, so easy. You're one of the holy ones. Just close your eyes and everything stops. Just imagine it, what it's like. Now, how are you feeling now? What's it like in your mind? You get the idea? Should carry on meditating now, but I've got some more talk to go, so open your eyes now. Now you know how to use this imagination to begin the meditation. One of the other imaginations which I use and I teach, if you don't imagine yourself in this beautiful, perfect, idyllic monastery, imagine yourself at the time in your past when you were the most peaceful, the most still, the most beautiful experience you've ever had of serenity and ease. Close your eyes and imagine it again. And as you're back there, you fill in the picture, fill in the scenery outside, the place, the building, or the trees if it was outside, day or night, what time was it? Put in as much detail as possible for the most peaceful time in your life. And having spent 2 or 3 minutes just imagining and filling in that picture, then you let the picture go, but you keep the peace. And then say, watch your breath, breathing in, breathing out. You let go of the details, but you keep the feeling, and you incorporate that with your breath. That is beautiful. That works. You see, you're already meditating. Isn't it easy to do when you do these imaginations? The other imagination, which imagination is not much time gone, but it's not right. You can also imagine, one of the other imaginations, if you're really having a difficult time and nothing is working for you, and even all these imaginations, you know, you just don't believe in it because you're a skeptic and you're one of the gasworks people. You never want to have any happiness anyway. If you're really a hard case, one of these hard nuts to crack, another imagination, a little imaginary exercise I found very effective. You sit down, you can do this any time, you sit down, you close your eyes, and then you imagine you find an old shoebox or something about that size, an old empty box. And then you think, I'm going to give myself a gift. That depends what you really want. You can have a gift like just peace, or like forgiveness if you feel guilty about something. Or give yourself the gift of like loving kindness, metta, because you've been hard on yourself. No matter what the gift is, I would say freedom, because you feel just so enclosed, you just don't know what to do, but you can't do it. So say you want to give yourself the gift of freedom. Then imagine that empty shoebox. And imagine yourself putting freedom inside that box. However you imagine it to be, if it was just a word, put freedom inside there. As much as you can possibly put in that box. And imagine putting the lid on the box, very gently. And then looking around in your imaginary mind and finding some gift wrapping paper. And very slowly wrapping that box with the gift wrap paper, getting some tape to seal it down, making neat corners, taping it down as when you are making a gift to an important person. And then you find some ribbon and tie it around with a nice little bow. But before you actually give that gift, you always put these little greetings cards or this gift card on, only a small card. So you find a nice card with a beautiful picture on, and you tie it or tape it onto the box, and you write your wish to me with love for me, XXX. Or a couple of little hearts, all in your imagination. And then in your imagination you push the box aside and imagining you're forgetting about it. And having a mouth to imagine you've forgotten about it, you imagine yourself finding it again. Oh, there's a box here, I wonder what it is. And you imagine looking at this little card. Oh, it's for me. With imagination, you are free to do whatever you like. Oh, it's to me. Who's it from? Ah, it's for me. Isn't that nice? All these lovely kisses. To me, with love for me. I wonder what it is, you imaginary thing. So you don't tear the thing apart. Very slowly, you untie the ribbon. And then you unpack the beautiful paper, because you want to keep it maybe for later. I wonder what it is, I wonder what it is. Like the excitement you have when you open a present from someone who cares for you. And you open it up. Ah, oh, it's freedom. How did they know that's what I want? Now, throughout the whole process, it works. Throughout the whole imaginary process, the more complicated you make it, the longer it lasts, the more you are reinforcing the psychological message of giving yourself the gift of freedom. It's very easy to say, just give yourself forgiveness. But if you make a whole ceremony out of it, minutes of commentary all around the same theme, you find it actually works. When you open that up, you find you have received the gift of freedom. And no one else can give you these things. I can't really give you love. I can't give you peace. I might have been trying all week, but I can't do it. They say Buddhas can only show the way. You have to give yourself freedom. You have to give yourself peace. You have to give yourself letting go. And that's a beautiful way of doing it. This wonderful imaginary exercise. And once you get into doing this, you can put anything in your box. And you put it in there, you get into this imaginary exercise. It is like a visualization exercise. Even if you are sick, you can put good health in your box. But you've got to do it properly and unwrap it slowly. And afterwards, wow, what a nice gift that is. Someone has given me, from the love of their heart, the gift of health. And because of its psychological potency, it works. So it's another way you can use the imagination of the mind. Sure, it is a commentary, but it's a commentary on one thing. It is focused, it's not going all over the place. And it's using the power of conditioning of the mind, of a very gentle will, which is sustained on one thing for a long period of time and gives a palpable effect. You find you can do it. The power of will, belief, brainwashing is that strong. And you should know that by now if you've read any psychology journals or any reports. And we make use of that in our meditation. So you can do those imaginations and visualizations. These are all part of inspiring yourself. I was going to mention all these other types of meditation, things like body contemplation. You only do body contemplation just to look at this body, but you've been contemplating enough already, it's been hurting enough already. But just know, this is just a body, it's nothing to do with me, not mine. And just drop it, leave it alone. If it was your business, you're going to have to worry about it, because it's not your business. Leave it alone. But with that body contemplation, sometimes, now if you're not very, very sick, sometimes it's helpful just to notice what the body's doing. Because I know from personal experience that sometimes, that before you get sick, the body is always telling you, giving you warnings. But we never heed those warnings because we are too busy. We are too caught up with other things to actually listen to the body. That's why one of the body contemplations is just asking your body, how do you feel? At the beginning of the meditation, is anything which needs to be moved or scratched? I tell people in the public meditation sessions, the reason why we ask people to close their eyes in meditation, in the Zen tradition you keep your eyes open, but in our tradition you keep your eyes closed. Because with your eyes closed you can start to scratch those things you wouldn't scratch in public, you can pick your nose, do whatever, because no one's looking. So it is much more comforting. You wouldn't be able to do that, you just have to endure if everyone had their eyes open. So you can ask your body, now what does it need? And be kind. If you ask, you get an answer. And sometimes body contemplation is that, is being aware of the body. And to get that awareness, just ask the question. And you're aware of that area of the body which needs some help. Just send it some energy. It's interesting in the meditation that sometimes with body contemplation, you become aware of the body. And all you need to do is just to be aware of it, and it relaxes. One of the methods of dealing with pain, again using imagination, if you've got a pain in the body, like a really strong area of pain, what happens usually is the muscles contract around and you get this ball of intense energy called pain. And a lot of times we just don't want it, we try and get rid of it, which means it contracts even further. It's almost like puts up its defences because it feels it's attacked by us and gets even more sort of nasty. So one of the ways I do it, I look at that pain, and instead of like fighting it, I join it, I expand it. Because the reason why it really hurts is because it's in a small area, concentrated ball of tough negative energy. And so I imagine it expanding. I expand to fill my whole body. So it's not just in my knee, it's just throughout my whole body. Whenever you expand anything, it's its nature to get less dense. It becomes softer. Sure, it fills more space, but it gets less intense as it expands. And you expand it even further to fill the whole room. Expand it to fill the whole universe. What was once a solid ice cube, hard and tough, is now just like liquid water, and you expand it to become like steam. You expand it to become like a cloud, until it vaporizes, it fills the whole universe. And when it fills everything, it's so dilute, it disappears. It's not there. I expand my pain instead of contracting it. It's a marvelous way of doing it. It's a visualization. Because it expands, it always gets less dense. It just goes so less dense, it's not even there anymore. Just like a cloud evaporating. The water is still there, it's just expanded so far you can't see it. Like it's not there. It's a great visualization to do with pains. But a lot of times, just look at it, just relax, it just disappears. Relax, it just disappears. If you fight it, it gets stronger. So that's some of the body contemplations you do. And after I look at my body, okay, you're okay, body. Sometimes I look upon it like a car. Many of you came here in a car. What have you done with it? You put it in the car park. The gates of the car park are locked. Your car is locked. You've got the alarm system on. So you don't need to worry about it anymore. You can leave your car out there in the full knowledge you'll be safe. This is like your body. You set it down. You park it on your cushion. Or on your chair, wherever you want to park it. This is the car park of your body. You've got a big P on there somewhere. And you just lock it up, make sure it's okay, put on the alarm system, and leave it alone. Bye bye, body. So you can go off and enjoy yourself. Imagine having to bring your car into this hall. Imagine having to bring the car into the shopping centre. Actually, not actually in the car park, actually in the shopping centre itself. Imagine you can never leave your car alone. What a pain that would be. It's the same with your body. You lock it up, put it in the car park, turn on the alarm system, and bye-bye body. That's body contemplation. Once it's safe and secure, you can let it go. When you do walking meditation, you can't let the body go because it's always there. You have to walk. But when you're doing walking meditation, very quickly, oh my goodness, walking meditation means that you just same stages of meditation as with the breathing. First stage of meditation, present moment awareness. So I am walking now. You don't think, how many minutes have I got to walk for? You don't think, how many minutes are there left for lunch? How many minutes do I have to kill before I can get something to eat? We don't break the first precept, which is killing living beings. Time is a living being, so don't kill time. And so we're not killing time, we're just being here. So present moment awareness becomes your main thing. You can be aware of many other things, but like in anything, I can hold up a sheet of paper, you can be aware of its colour, its size, the writing on it. There's many aspects which you can be aware of on this piece of paper, but if you're seeing if your name's on it, that's the only thing you're really looking for. You know, the sort of piece of black which spells out your name. In present moment awareness, it's just the presence is the only thing you're looking for. That's the main object, the nowness of whatever experience you're having. That's what you're focusing on, that it's now, now. It doesn't matter what it is, but as long as it's now. Pleasant, unpleasant, doesn't matter, as long as it's now. Whatever sense it is, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or knowing, as long as it's now. So the nowness becomes your main object. And as you develop the nowness, the next thing you know, you develop in walking meditation is silence. Just see how silently you can walk, how you can totally be there, your mind fully empty to whatever sensory experience is happening in the moment, and you're not filling in the gaps with those commentary. If you listen to the sound of the lawnmower and the birds, fully absorbing every moment, because the commentary just blocks out so much of what's happening, and just fully here silently in the moment as you're walking backwards and forwards. Usually you watch about 2 meters in front of you. With your eyes open. The reason you do that is in case there's any sticks, snakes, or whatever else you're going to fall over. Even if you're walking in here, 2 meters in front, put your eyes down there, so that gives you a sense of safety. You know you're not going to walk into a big hole or anything. And then you just walk backwards and forwards. Usually, you know, some people say about 20 paces, sometimes 30 paces, some less, some more. It doesn't really matter. Because if it's too long, you know, you sort of get too long before you can actually stop and just recollect yourself. Too short, you're always turning around. Some people, I never tried this myself, have actually gone around in a circle, so don't have to stop. Around and round 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 and round. Interesting way of doing things. But, you know, maybe give it a try, see what happens. But the point is, you just make it nice and simple. If it's out in the garden, you can take your shoes off and put one on one end, one on the other end, or go between two trees, whatever is nice and simple, so you don't have to think too much. I like to do walking meditation with my shoes off, because you can actually feel the ground. It's just more things to be interested in. So once you've got present moment awareness and silence, next thing, just like you're watching the breath, in, breath, out, breath, in, breath, out, breath. In walking meditation, it's left foot moving, right foot moving. Left foot moving, right foot moving. Just like in, out, left, right, the same sort of thing. And then when you get to the full awareness of the breath, seeing the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, seeing the gap between the breaths, seeing the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, you have the full awareness of feet moving. So it's not just left, right, left, right, left, right. You see the beginning of a left foot moving. What part of the foot leaves the ground first? Does it go straight up or at an angle? Go back this way or sideways? How does your feet move when you're walking? You walk naturally, but you just observe. And actually, how does it move forward? And what part of the foot, your foot, meets the ground first of all? What lasts? And once that foot has touched the ground, what happens next? You notice the whole weight go from one foot to the other to release the next foot to do its movement. So you become aware of all the movements of the feet, which is the next stage of the walking meditation. And the last stage, the only stage which I go to with walking meditation, the last stage which I do, is just like you have the beautiful breath, you have the beautiful step. As you're moving, it's just so delightful and delicious. It's beautiful, wonderful just to walk. You feel it all. This is nice. This is delightful. This is lovely. And that's how you can develop the same stages as with breath, almost, with the walking meditation. And you know that you've got to the stage of the beautiful walking when you're just walking backwards and forwards. You're just so happy, so content. You don't want to be anywhere else. It's just so peaceful, so delightful. You can just walk for hours that way. So happy, so lovely. I always tell the story when my first year as a monk in Thailand, when I used to do a lot of walking meditation this was in the middle of Bangkok, in the main hall, the main meditation hall, which no one used, on the outside, you could walk backwards and forwards. And there was a big grandfather clock inside, which would chime the quarter hours. And I'd always take half an hour to go from one end to the other, which was maybe about, you know, from here to that wall over there, maybe a bit further, maybe half as much again, and half an hour to go back again. And I wasn't forcing it. You walk naturally, but as you calm down, there's so much going on in the movement of your feet, you can't rush it. And I was, many times I was just so peaceful, just walk over there and walk back again, took a whole hour, and it's not that far. And you get into such deep and peaceful meditation. And on this one occasion, which I remember, just shows you how deep you can get, I had forgotten there was a dana, a ceremony I had to go to. They told me in the morning, but I got into nice meditation, I forgot all about it. So I hadn't turned up, and they sent a monk to come and get me. And this monk came right up to me, and you know, when you're in deep meditation, and someone is not in deep meditation, they can feel so coarse. And so they came up to me, and I was just, my eyes were 2 meters in front of me, just watching the movement of the feet. So nice, the left foot moving up slowly and just moving back. My foot moves back a bit before it moves forward. And then this monk said, "Bahuang So, you've got to come to a dana." left foot moving up, going forward. Baba Wangsa, you have to come to a dana. And I always remember this, it's very clear. It's like, you know, the simile of like the voice 1,000 miles away. You could hardly hear it, and it was right next to my ear, trying to get my attention. And I recall that I did hear him. But I just couldn't answer him. I couldn't actually turn my head. And it took about a minute to turn my head very slowly. As I noticed it just turning, very slowly turning. And I just was I was really trying to be sort of polite and do the right thing. It took me about a minute to actually to turn my head. I'm going really fast now compared to what I was doing. And turned to him, and all I could say is, "What?" It was a nice experience because it showed me just actually how still and peaceful I've become. You know, in this beautiful state of mind where you're walking, you just can't be taken out. And no, I had to. It was only a very junior monk, and it was a senior monk asking me, and I had to come out. So I had to force myself out. But you can get so still and peaceful doing walking meditation that way. If you want to do lying meditation, do it the same. Lay down, sort of watch the be present moment awareness, be silent. You can do actually breath meditation when you're lying down, just watching the breath go in, go out, just drop the body, and you're into nice, deep, peaceful meditations. I was going to do all sorts of other meditations today, but never mind, I've lost my time now. I'll do a metta meditation on tomorrow. That's the other one, main one I was going to do. One thing with metta meditation, though, remember you can do metta with anything. It doesn't have to be a person, it can be a thing. You do metta meditation towards your body or towards your feelings and or pain in the body. The door of my heart's open to the pain. But in particular, try doing metta meditation to your breath. Because when I first combined metta and breath meditation, put them all together, it was incredibly powerful. So deep meditation was just so easy, and you slept in deep meditation, you know, dreams of jhanas and stuff. It was an amazing experience. But what it was actually you have the breath and you open the door of your heart to it. You care for the breath, you love the breath, just like a mother loves her only child, will give their life for her only child. So you give your life for your breath. You're just watching it, you're doting on the breath, just like you see these little babies who come to our temple, and every woman wants to hold a baby. Because women love little babies, they're so cute and nice. And this little breath is just being born into your body. It's just so nice, it's been feeding your oxygen ever since you were born. Have you ever said, "Thank you, breath, for looking after me, for caring for me"? It does that day and night without any sort of wanting any gratitude. Never ask for thanks. It just goes in and out of your body, giving you life every minute of the day. And now you look at this breath, it's been looking after you for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Ah, nice breath. Thank you so much for giving me all this oxygen. And you think, look upon this breath with softness and tenderness. It is so nice, breath. The door of my heart, you're my best friend. When you look upon the breath with metta, with loving kindness, then the breath, it looks so beautiful and soft and nice. You can't help but washing it and hanging out with it. Just like you wash a baby and hold a baby. It is so cute. My little breath is just so cute and lovely. You keep washing the breath, and then it gets so happy. You go into jhanas very easily. So try loving kindness on the breath. It's so easy. You join them together. So that's actually how it works. So those are some other extra skillful means from my armory. Not armory, that's not the wrong word, that's better. From my tool chest of skillful means how to meditate. So many there today. So try imaginations, inspirations, and what else to do? Walking meditation, a loving kindness on the breath. So lots of little things there. Use your imagination. If you can't watch the breath, just imagine you can. If you can't be in jhanas, imagine what it's like to be in jhana. Come and sit down and imagine. A beautiful nimitta coming up. Imagine it. And you're very close. try it, experiment, it works. So any questions about using imaginations, inspirations and other stuff? Imagine you can ask a question. See, it works. You know I can't say that. That's against my rules. I can't imagine breaking my rules. There's no exclusion for imaginary stuff. You know, there's lots of people who can get into deep meditation. In this room of the world, all you need to do is to put it down. Let it go. What the Buddha said is not how many do or don't. He said, if this is what you do, the way you practice, this is what happens. It's cause and effect. It's completely independent of you. That's what no self is. So whether you think you can do it or you can't do it, it's completely irrelevant. Of the two, it's better to think you can, because that is helpful. Thinking you can't is just an obstacle. Both are wrong, because there's no one in there at all. But of the two, the best delusion is thinking you can. And that's one of the reasons why I teach this way, is to inspire, encourage you. And in all the experience which I've had as a teacher, when you tell people they can, they do. When you say, no, it's really difficult, it's very, very hard, you only have to be a special person to get in these dharmas, then no one thinks they're that special, and no one even gets close. So you can. If you really believe that, you will. You've been to motivational seminars before. The reason why those motivational seminars are well attended is because there's a lot of truth in that. And part of the job as being a teacher is to motivate you. And I can only motivate you with sincerity. It can be done, you can do it. Just get all the doubts out of the way. Follow the practice, just do what's said to be done, and it works. Yes. Yeah, I think sometimes one of the reasons for indecisiveness is worrying what people are going to talk about you or think about you, coming from the ego. Instead of just doing it, oh, this is, might as well do this. And you know, if you worry, oh, it's going to go wrong, or it might go right, and you can't make a decision because you've got too much personal investment in the outcome. And the more you disappear, the less ego there is, the less self is there. You don't worry what happens in the end. If you really stuff up and make an idiot of yourself, and then you give a lot of happiness by making other people laugh. If you do something, well, oh, great, you know, you've achieved something, well done. You know, that's one of the reasons why when I decided to take on being an abbot, being a teacher, I had two possibilities. You become a great teacher, that'd be good, you'd be able to help others and make lots of good karma. But if I was really a terrible teacher and everybody just, they hated my talks and they thought it was completely impossible and blah 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 and no one ever came again, that would be even better. I could be a nice hermit monk, which is really what I like. So it didn't matter, both outcomes were win-win. So you just chose which, whichever one you wanted to. A lot of indecisiveness is worry, and worry is about fear, what it's going to do to you. And then make a decision, see what happens. It's all the same, it doesn't really matter what happens, make a decision this way or that way, you can both make use of both of them. So just make a decision and don't worry about it. Okay, so now we have the closing interviews today and tomorrow. The spaces are empty there for you to write your your conventional names on, not who you really are but who you're told you are, and take those five candles into the interview room, and who knows, just one thing which might be said, that might be the trigger, the paratagosa, the words of another, and bam, then you're away. But if you don't think that's going to happen to you, then don't put your name down at all. And if you do put your name down, if I can ask, don't sort of put spaces like, you know, one in the morning, one in the 9 o'clock, the other one at 9:30, the other one at sort of 10 past 10. Please put them in a line out of compassion for me, because otherwise you're in there and away for another 10 minutes or half an hour, and then another one comes and they comes in dribs and drabs. So just put it like in a nice line, one after the other, and that way that, you know, maybe if you finish not many people, I can have meditate at 10 o'clock as well. Okay, so off you go. Yeah, what? It's uncountable. You can't count them. Oh, why do people want to know that? What I want to know is, are you an arahat yet? And if not, why not? How long have I been teaching you, Yenny? Surely, out of respect for your teachers, and out of respect for Ajahn Priyan as well as your main teacher, surely, out of respect for him, you're going to make him happy next time you see him. He says, Yenny, how's your meditation going? Oh, Ajahn, I've got jhanas, I'm enlightened. So then you will know the answer to your question. There's one more. You got a question? Go ahead. Yeah. It does, yeah. And look, one of the reasons that we don't say who is and who isn't, or give any tricks, any information that way, is because if we did say this monk was a stream winner, this monk was an arahat, that guy at the end is a nobody, then that's not true. By the way, that's just an example. What it means is, straight away we get this aristocracy, this hierarchy, you know, in the Sangha. I'm better than him, he's worse than me.